Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
How are you, Kelly?
Good. How are you doing, Jeff?
Good. I'm sitting here with our new fellow, Lawrence Brisky.
Good morning, Lawrence. Welcome.
Morning.
Hey, Kelly. Good morning.
Hey, is that Henry?
Yep.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Everybody staying cool this summer?
Yes.
Good.
Through the miracle of air conditioning.
Right. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Well, it's 15 past the hour, so let's jump in, I guess. All right. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining me on this, at least on the East Coast, summery morning. And today I have for you several articles to discuss. And right off the bat, I thought the most interesting article for the month of June of this year was the one out of Kirk Jones Group in San Francisco, and it has to do with basically trying to understand the significance of peribronchial metaplasia in the setting of a UIP pattern histologically. And what they did was look at all their patients during a 16-year period from 2000 to 2016 in which the pattern on surgical lung biopsy was UIP, and through a multidisciplinary conference, they did have a clinical diagnosis established. So this they had to have a diagnosis established through MDC. And then they excluded patients with known connective, or what they determined to be connective tissue disease-associated interstitial lung disease, number one. And number two, as an exclusionary feature, were patients whose biopsies only showed honeycombing. And what they did in terms of what they called bronchocentric fibrosis was they scored it. And if it was just a little bit of peribronchial metaplasia, they gave it a score of 1. And obviously, if there was none, they gave it a score of 0. And then moving up their scoring system, which they defined arbitrarily as, quote, prominent alveolar septal thickening with peribronchial metaplasia, they gave that a score of 2. And then finally, the most severe was bronchiolocentric septal thickening in the presence of architectural distortion, which they gave a score of 3. And what the first thing off the bat I was wondering is, how did they distinguish that severe bronchocentric thickening with metaplasia and distortion from microscopic honeycombing? And what they said was that the bronchocentric fibrosis had to be a near an airway, obviously, in a central location near a pulmonary artery. If they couldn't tell exactly where it was, it had to be near an artery. And there had to be some degree of normal septa between that fibrosis and the pleura to make sure that we weren't just dealing with microscopic honeycombing. So those were the inclusionary and exclusionary criteria. And to see exactly what they're talking about, obviously for copyright purposes, I couldn't put it in the summary, but if anyone has an opportunity to look at the actual paper, figure 1 nicely shows exactly what they're talking about in terms of their scoring system for bronchiolocentric fibrosis. And then it gets a little bit confusing in terms of understanding who was and wasn't included, so I just direct people to figure 2 as we go through the numbers. And what they found using all those criteria was a cohort of 252 patients. And from that, they had 85% of those, or 215 patients, had a MDC diagnosis of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. So that's one arm, if you will, of the cohort. And then they looked at who did and didn't have bronchiolocentric fibrosis. And out of the 252 patients who had MDC diagnosis of IPF and UIP on biopsy, 38% of all comers had bronchiolocentric fibrosis. Now, in terms of the ones who had an MDC diagnosis of IPF, 33% had bronchiolocentric fibrosis. And then if you follow along in terms of where the other baskets were of who had what, those who had an MDC diagnosis that wasn't IPF, 65% of those had bronchiolocentric fibrosis. And then if you did the stats, by multivariate analysis, bronchiolocentric fibrosis was significantly associated with a diagnosis other than IPF, but it wasn't associated with, significantly at least, with some of the things one would think a priori would be associated with a non-IPF diagnosis, such as they couldn't significantly associate environmental exposures, a.k.a. Hypersensitivity pneumonitis cause. They couldn't associate significantly reflux, smoking, or even radiologic patterns, a definite UIP pattern versus a definite not UIP pattern, et cetera, with having a non-IPF diagnosis and bronchiolocentric fibrosis with a UIP pattern on biopsy.
Kelly?
Yeah.
So was there any way for them to tease out the extent to which the bronchiolocentric fibrosis was actually a driver of the MDD conclusion that they weren't IPF? I mean, I could imagine.
Right. Yeah.
In which case this is self-fulfilling.
Right, exactly. And that's an excellent question. And I think, let me just triple check this, but I do believe, it was kind of confusing because in the materials and methods, they said that the registry was prospectively developed, and then it says the clinical diagnosis was established at the time of evaluation, and then it says that the biopsies were reviewed. So it's not the way it's written, and I'll have to ask Kirk and maybe someone else who's had or will have an opportunity to read through the study. It's not entirely clear to me whether this was purely a prospective study, which, to your point, in that case, as you say, would be a self-fulfilling prophecy, or if it was they were prospectively identified, but then from a retrospective standpoint, the biopsies were re-reviewed. So it's not actually 100% clear to me which it was, Jeff. But an excellent question to try to follow up, and I unfortunately don't have the entire clear answer on that. But maybe as I'm droning on here, somebody can glean that out.
One way to get at that would be to look at the compare the first half of that 16-year period with the second half, because there's no question
yeah.
In the last 5 or 6 years we've been overdiagnosing all sorts of central lobular things.
Sure enough. Thanks for being on the call, Tom. Nice to hear from you.
Hey, Tom?
Yeah.
Is this what retirement looks like?
Well, I'm back in business.
Oh, you are?
Yeah,
wow. Yeah.
He's got a sexy website, too.
Wow, nice to hear you.
Well, we'll see where it goes.
So with that asterisk in mind, they also looked at other factors that one might think would be related to a non-IPF diagnosis, such as MUC5B genotype and telomere length. And there wasn't a significant association with that. And then finally, importantly as well, is that apparently the presence of this bronchiolocentric fibrosis did not impact survival time in and of itself. As far as that group that weren't felt to have IPF at MDC and had histologic UIP with bronchiolocentric fibrosis, what were they ultimately classified as? And as one might expect, 13 of the 24 were chronic HP. Another 10 were unclassifiable, and one was labeled as other, but they didn't, as best I can tell, go into what that other actually meant, which is curious. But I think it's a very important, you know, clinical pathologic question that we are struggling with more and more. As we all know, we get the non-easy cases at biopsy and what to do with this bronchiolocentric fibrosis, and some people seem to put a lot of weight, is that it's got to be chronic HP, and others say, oh, even if we don't find food material, it has to be reflux, and et cetera, and then basically they said that although bronchiolocentric fibrosis in a background of UIP is associated with a diagnosis clinically of something other than IPF, most commonly HP, it's important to keep in mind that at least in their hands, about one-third of patients who do, after everything is said and done, have an MDC diagnosis of IPF, do have bronchiolocentric fibrosis on biopsy. And so their point being that bronchiolocentric fibrosis should not, of course, exclude a diagnosis of IPF. And then secondly, importantly, that it appears not to have any import in terms of survival of patients who have it. So I'd be very, I thought it was thought-provoking, and it's something that has been talked about both at the last evening special, or evening PPS conference at USCAP, and then also touched on a little bit at the most recent PPS biannual meeting with some back and forth between people, and I think it's a topic that's not going to go away, and be very interested to hear people's thoughts about it.
Did they mention even a single granuloma?
Good point, Tom. Let me look quickly whether that was exclusionary or not. Let's see. They looked for them in terms of the things that they looked for in the materials and methods. They looked for a bunch of things. Let me double check here. Let me see. Just looking quickly. They certainly, the short answer for me is they certainly didn't dwell on them in the results that I can see. It seems like they looked for them, but they're not well addressed in the results, at least in my recollection here. The results section is actually much briefer than the materials and methods.
Seems to be unusual, 250 biopsies and not a single granuloma.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they look for them, but then they don't delineate some of the features that they looked for in terms of what they saw in terms of the results, which is curious.
Kelly, was there any relationship with autoimmune disease?
Right. So importantly, Margaret, they specifically excluded patients that were, and again, they don't actually go into how far they went into looking for collagen vascular disease, but through MDC, if the patient was thought or found to have evidence of collagen vascular disease, they were specifically excluded from the study. But they don't actually specifically say whether that was by serology or physical findings or what. It just was a pat phrase that they were eliminated.
You kind of think it would be a diagnosis that they had already, wouldn't you? So they're not being included in people that might be called IPAP or something like that.
Right, right.
Kelly, this is Henry. Was there any association with degree of, you know, bronchial ascent? So they scored them.
Yes, sorry.
One to three.
Absolutely. Sorry. I skipped over that. I neglected to mention that, Tom. And let's see. They only considered a score of two or three, that being either prominent alveolar septal thickening with peribronchial metaplasia or severe septal thickening with architectural distortion, the score 2 and 3 as present. And if there was if it was absent, or if it was only minimal to mild septal thickening with peribronchial metaplasia, they call that no. So basically, if you pull up figure 1 there, A and B would be no, and then C and D would be yes for what they counted as bronchiolocentric fibrosis. So it had to be pretty significant. It wasn't these little whiffs of PBM.
Thanks.
Yeah. I don't know, from a practical standpoint, any thoughts? It just seems like a problem that's obviously not going away, but is people seem to be all over the map in terms of what to do with it and what to ascribe it to. Silence is golden.
Well, then I'll speak up. I'm sure that if Travis and I went back and look at those cases from Michigan that Jeff could also look at.
Yeah.
We'd see it in a whole lot of those cases, and the time we made that diagnosis, we didn't key into this stuff, and we might very well call them differently now.
I am.
So this study says maybe we weren't so far off.
Yeah, and I think that we've made way too much of this. I mean, the fact that the airways are involved in UIP has been known for decades, actually.
Mm-hmm.
That was studied at the NIH. Granted, the criteria have changed a bit, but it's not like all of those patients didn't have IPF.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And now I hear people call somebody fibrotic HP just because they have PBM and nothing else. And I think that this just says that pendulum should swing back.
Right, right, exactly. I get at the end of the day, I guess, and I that's very well put. And I think it's probably at the end of the day, the most important thing is the bottom line is, whatever you call these people, that it seems not to impact on survival. So if they have a UIP pattern and have bronchiolocentric fibrosis, or they don't, whatever you call them, they seem to have the same survival, which at the end of the day is what it boils down to, I guess.
And I think that's true at end-stage disease, too. Mm-hmm. There was a Japanese autopsy study comparing IPF to HP, and peribronchiolar metaplasia was nearly universal in both groups. There was just more of it in the HP group. So I just think we assign it diagnostic value that it doesn't have.
Right, right. Got it. Good. Any other comments about that study? Great. All right. Well, slightly along the same vein, but a little bit different, is this single institution study out of Japan that is by Kinoshita and group in Fukuoka, Japan. What it looks at, or what it purports to start out saying that it's looking at, is this entity of combined pulmonary fibrosis and emphysema. And they go a little bit into the history of that. There was a group that actually proposed that terminology in 2005, that if you look back at that original article, it was defined as a smoking-related condition that featured emphysema in the upper lobes and interstitial fibrosis in the lower lobes with some spirometry abnormalities suggesting severe gas exchange impairment. So that's what they stated that they were looking at. But what it gets into is not so clear to me, and maybe somebody can help me out here. But they then looked at the intrapulmonary distribution of emphysema and fibrosis in patients who had a clinical diagnosis of IPF who also had emphysema. So I don't know if we're dealing with the same thing as was originally proposed in 2005 or not as the baseline of what we're dealing with the study. But be that as it may, what the patients had to have to be included was a clinical diagnosis of IPF, whatever that means, and they had to have tissue that included both upper and lower lobes. And they got that either by explant, so patients going for lung transplantation, or at autopsy. And then as far as the issue of emphysema, how that was defined was purely radiographically. And they said that patients had to have greater than 25% of the lung being occupied by emphysema. Now, I don't know how that flies from a radiographic standpoint or not in terms of how one defines that, but that was their definition. And this was a retrospective study. So what they had was 19 patients, and they looked at them, and they used the current classification terminology. Nine had definite UIP, probable UIP in eight of them, and then two had indeterminate for UIP. They made a point to look at some other features, as one should, obviously, in patients who were probably heavy smokers. And the smoking-related interstitial fibrosis, that subpleural dense hyalinized fibrosis, was seen in 16% of cases. But they made sure to say that was only present in a very localized area and seemed to be separate from the UIP pattern in their cohort. And as far as the intrapulmonary distribution of fibrosis and emphysema, what they found was that none of the patients had the distribution that was described in the so-called combined pulmonary fibrosis and emphysema. So none of them had just emphysema up in the upper lobes and fibrosis in the lower lobes. It was mixed in both the upper and lower lobes. And they said sometimes they were adjacent to one another, sometimes they were admixed with one another, and making the boundary between the two somewhat obscure, which I imagine would make the diagnosis of UIP all the more difficult. So they again circled back in their discussion to this CPFE and its original proposal. And they say that they really haven't seen any cases where the fibrosis and emphysema exist separately. Rather, they're in coexistence in the same lobe. And to me, this study, again, raises some more questions because it doesn't really address whether IPF with emphysema is something that's different from the CPFE or their distinct entities. And it doesn't really tie in to the whole potpourri of and proliferation of terms that have been used by various authors, some of which are probably on the call here, in terms of smoking-related interstitial fibrosis, RVILD with fibrosis, airspace enlargement with fibrosis, and there are probably others that I'm not mentioning as well. So for me, I think it is an interesting finding, but I don't think we have one term that conclusively marries all these terminologies together, and I think it makes it difficult for those looking at these cases. Thoughts?
I think it's a non-study.
Fair enough.
And I think I'd have to go back to that 2005 article from
yeah.
Cochran, But I think that that was a radiologic diagnosis of severe emphysema in the upper lobe. And then lower lobe diagnosis, I don't remember how they made.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask any radiologist, they will tell you that in UIP-IPF, there's always a little bit of upper lobe involvement, but it's just much less severe than the lower lobe.
Yeah.
So to me, the cases that Kotan and the other guy, whose name I'm blocking out at the moment, those were just the severe end of the spectrum, and that if we look at any patient with UIP-IPF who smokes, we'll probably find a little emphysema, and it'll tend to be in the upper lobe. So that to me, this is not a surprising finding at all, and I never really did buy that CPFE study because, I mean, other than the, just the end of the spectrum, that have those odd functional abnormalities where the mechanics of lung function are preserved, but the diffusing capacity is severely compromised.
And I think that's a great summary. They were defined purely radiologically in Cotton's study, and most of the pathology literature since has demonstrated that the histology is heterogeneous. Some have UIP, and some probably have SRIF, and some probably have something else. And Cotton has convened an ATS-ERS-supported project team to publish yet another white paper on how to think about these things. And there's been heated debate at their first meeting at the ATS about what role, if any, pathology plays in defining this as a discrete entity.
Mm-hmm. How, just from a practical standpoint, when anyone here gets a case that has severe emphysema and fibrosis, what kinds of things do you work through to try to be able to get to a diagnosis of IPF, or excuse me, of UIP in the setting of severe emphysema versus another diagnosis so one doesn't go down the tubes?
I think you use the same criteria you use at any other time, just sort of subtract the emphysema.
Got it.
Yeah, and don't overinterpret the emphysema with some mild interstitial fibrosis with honeycomb. But and you know, just because you get there's a predominance of one in one lobe versus, you know, upper versus lower lobe, there's overlap all the time. They're weird cases to look at.
Mm-hmm. I was curious. Has anyone struggled with? Obviously not on immunohistochemistry, but has anyone had a case where they really struggled with something like LCH, like UIP mimicking LCH in severe emphysema because the architecture is so distorted from the emphysema that the fibrosis can presumably kind of look a little bit stellate?
Short answer is yes, and then the smokers can get both. So
yeah,
they struggle with a smoker who has UIP and LCH-like areas.
Got it, yeah.
I think the good news is I think the bulk of the evidence would say that if you have bad emphysema and fibrotic lung disease, whatever you call it, you're in trouble.
Got it.
You're not going to get a biopsy. They're not going to do a biopsy.
Right. True, yes. Maybe these cases won't come to us, so good. All right, good discussion. Appreciate that. If there isn't anything else on that non-study, let's move on to the next one. And just changing gears for those who are more neoplastically inclined, I threw in this article from a group out of Denmark that looked at a large series of neuroendocrine tumors that was fairly robustly characterized. And what they excluded small cell carcinoma and looked carefully at typical and atypical carcinoids and large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. So this was a retrospective study, as I mentioned, at a single European institution. And they had 252 seems to be a popular number of patients included in studies. So if you want to get your study published, apparently you need 252 patients today. And that broke down into, as one might expect, the majority of them were typical carcinoids, followed by large cell neuroendocrine, and then finally the smallest number were atypical carcinoids. And they looked at a variety of differences in clinical pathologic parameters in these patients and found a number of things that were significant. Age was significant between age of diagnosis was significant between those three groups, as was gender. There were more females who had typical carcinoid than the other groups. Although they said it was significant for all, it was 73% female for typical and 72% for atypical, so I'm not sure how that's significant, but go figure. Smoking status was also significant, as one might expect. There were more never smokers, although less than half were never smokers, even so, who had typical carcinoid. And then only 12% of the large cell neuroendocrine patients were never smokers. They also looked at location, and just over half of the typicals were central, but a slight majority of both the atypicals and the large cells were peripheral. Somewhat important observation, I think, from an MDC and management standpoint was that PET positivity was observed in a very high proportion of all three tumor types. 95% of all the cases were PET positive. And that didn't vary, apparently, between the tumor types. So even typical carcinoids showed PET positivity. As one might expect also, the proportion of patients who presented with metastatic disease was highest in large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, very low in typical carcinoids. And then looking at what happened to them, it was not common for large cells to undergo surgical resection, whereas it was much more common for the typical and atypical carcinoids to do so. But importantly, irrespective of whatever tumor type among these three types patients had, the fact that they got resected meant that they had better survival, independent of other factors. Even patients who had node-positive typical carcinoid did better if they got resected. Just from a diagnostic standpoint, they looked at TTF1 positivity, and they actually found a fair proportion of typical carcinoids stained positively, 69%, and then the other two groups in the high 70s and low 80 percentiles, too. So that's the marker that they found in their hands was positive. Very rarely, large cell neuroendocrine can be negative for synaptophysin, they felt. They also tried to address the conundrum of what to do with mitoses versus Ki-67 and had a little discussion upon that. Importantly, they found that mitoses, necrosis, and Ki-67 weren't individually prognostic when you're trying to separate typical and atypical carcinoid, but if you used all three together, it was helpful for risk stratifying between those groups. So just to summarize, in this study, females predominated both in carcinoids and in large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, which is a departure from prior studies in which large cell had a male predominance. And they emphasized, again, that PET avidity can be seen in all three of these tumor types, including typical carcinoid, which hasn't really been the case in prior studies in terms of radiologic studies kind of intimating that PET wasn't a good modality for assessing the distribution of disease in typical carcinoid. And that's what I have, according to this study. I don't know if there's any thoughts or comments. I think it's just some things to keep in the back of the mind when you're dealing with these patients at MDC in terms of what is and is not likely.
Kelly, it doesn't look like they talk about the multifocal carcinoids, you know, the syndrome.
No. Unless I missed it in there, dipnic and such were not specifically addressed.
Yeah, I think they're probably in here, but they weren't addressed because there's a bunch of typical carcinoids that weren't resected, implying maybe they thought there were multiple nodules and they upstaged them.
Right, true enough.
(Clears throat) And maybe that's why they didn't address it, because if they did, they'd make it look like at the time they were misdiagnosed.
True.
So Kelly, I really like your take-home message, but I'm trying to figure out, what do we know now that we didn't know before?
Yeah, exactly. Not a whole lot. I think it doesn't add a whole lot aside from the slight differences from prior studies. I guess probably if somebody was intensely interested in large cell neuroendocrine, because there isn't much data out there specifically on that, one could kind of parse the data from this prognostically speaking. That might be a little bit useful, but yes, I don't think it adds an exceptional amount.
Well, the KI-67 chart is pretty.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Somebody needs to get a handle on that for the the other organ sites use that, and then at least my residents always want to order it, and we need to either get on board or get off board that train. I just don't know. All right. Well, let's look lastly, and if we have time, we'll touch on a few other things at purely morphologic article. So no statistics or heavy lifting involved in this, other than looking at some pretty pictures and how to hopefully not screw up the next time you see a case that looks like this. And that being xanthomatous thymomas. And as one might expect, it's out of one of the institutions that has a large interest in thymoma, MD Anderson, and they culled from their vast repository of thymomas that were resected 10 cases of what they're calling xanthomatous thymoma. And the key is that how they defined this was it was a thymoma that was, they specifically looked at tumors that were solid, that weren't cystic. So that takes a whole category of things that we're going to discuss in the differential out of the picture, but they were solid tumors that had an extensive xanthomatous component. 50 to 80% of the tumor had to be composed of xanthoma type of cells. And what they found in these 10 cases was equally split among men and women. In the fifth to seventh decade of life. Pretty nonspecific presenting symptoms. Some had chest pain. Some had chest pain with dyspnea, some dyspnea. And, again, they were all solid tumors in terms of their configuration. Most of them were encapsulated, but two did show minimal invasion, and the overall size of them ranged from 2.5 to 4.5 centimeters. As far as WHO tumor type they were, it was all over the spectrum. There were some type A, some mixed type, and then even one B3 atypical thymoma. And then importantly, again, none of them had a cystic component. None of them had necrosis or hemorrhage. All but one of them had follow-up and of a year to 2 years, and so far none have recurred. Not that long of a follow-up, but nonetheless. So I invite you to look at the pictures. Particularly, I found, all of them are instructive, but image one is slightly terrifying in terms of being able to easily miss these cases if they aren't adequately sampled. And that's what the authors try to hammer home, is that one needs to obviously liberally sample a thymic lesion or a mediastinal lesion that has extensive xanthomatous component, because they really may obscure an underlying neoplastic process. But there is a nice discussion of other things that would come into the differential one of which by far and away is most common probably among these rare lesions is the multiloculated thymic cyst that's showing breakdown. They point out apparently a pearl in that differential distinction is that in that situation, there's usually other accompanying inflammatory cells and some lymphoid hyperplasia or some scary pseudoepithelium of hyperplasia. You can just have xanthomatous inflammation and cystic fibromas that are undergoing degeneration as well. They also point out, obviously, if somebody has undergone neoadjuvant chemotherapy for a neoplasm, they have this mediastinal lesion, that xanthomatous response to chemotherapy can mimic this as well. And then finally, they talk about infectious processes in the mediastinum can have a big xanthomatous component. And then lastly, so-called thymic cholesterolomas. But in those cases, one should have cholesterol clefts and giant cells in the lesion as well. So in this small study, it doesn't appear that a xanthomatous component appears to affect outcome in any way, just something to recognize as something that can be diagnostically problematic. Exclude infection, exclude that something's a multiloculated thymic cyst, and for goodness sake, sample it liberally so that one can spot, hopefully, diagnostic areas of thymoma in these cases. Anybody seen one?
Yeah, I've just called these all mediastinal xanthomas.
Perfect. And there was no clinical... Yeah, no clinical outcome to that. Yeah.
I mean, if Caesar only has 10, most of us will never see one.
Right, exactly. But who knows? We could all see one tomorrow, and we'll be all set. So.
Yeah, I think this is a great choice. It felt so 1990s. It was awesome.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've seen... I've seen some multiloculated, or at least what I thought was multiloculated thymic cysts that had some degenerative changes like this, but I certainly will look carefully for things that possibly look like thymoma in the future in terms of that. So a purely morphologic study to balance out some of our more heavy-hitting stuff there. Let's see what else we can highlight for you. There was a study in Articles for Notation that looked at the perennial problem of trying to tease out pulmonary enteric primary carcinoma from metastatic colorectal carcinoma, which we all know is incredibly problematic because they behave similarly immunohistochemically, and they used a snazzy learning algorithm on the computer that looked at methylation data, and it seemed to work in terms of separating these cases. So I don't know if anyone, I assume somebody has that capability at their institution, and if in fact they've ever done such a thing, I'd be curious to know if anybody's looked into this themselves at all.
We have not.
Yeah, sounds like not, but it certainly would be. I don't know if this is...
To me, this is a made-up problem.
Okay, fair enough.
No, I mean, yes, lung cancers can look exactly the same, but if it's a solitary nodule in the lung that looks a little different than your average colon cancer, all of us are going to give the patient the benefit of the doubt and it's going to be resected.
Got it, yeah.
Would you use a methylation study to say, no, Mr. Smith, I'm sorry, we think it's a colon cancer, we're not going to take it out?
True enough.
But, you know, I think one of the challenges for our discipline is that we spend too much time talking to ourselves without understanding the impact on others. And I say that because I actually got a lengthy email from a patient's daughter over the weekend, and he was diagnosed with pulmonary adenocarcinoma with enteric differentiation. Mm. And she's been on the internet, and she wants to know which medical center has expertise in this particular flavor of lung cancer and why the doctors who treated her dad didn't acknowledge this type. and why he got the same sort of chemotherapy they give to patients with regular kinds of lung adenocarcinoma. So, I mean, to Tom's point, you know, this is useful for us to know about because it has diagnostic value.
Mm-hmm.
But it, you know, we like keep going with these things like they matter, and they don't.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess the issue obviously it becomes an issue in the uncommon patient who has had a colorectal neoplasia in the past.
Right.
But you're right; they don't necessarily dwell on that in this.
Well, I guess, but your point's well made, and I think it's a very useful thing to know about if you're in the business of making diagnoses.
Mm-hmm.
It's less important to know about if you're in the business of treating lung cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep describing it as an entity, like
yeah.
it has some value beyond that, doesn't make sense to me.
True enough. What else? In the waning time, just to point out a couple of papers on neoplasia, and just to one is long and short of it, encouraging submitting these type of cases for genetic analysis because they're finding more and more fusion partners for NUT. And it's not entirely clear whether these less common fusion partners are susceptible to these clinical trial bromodomain inhibitor therapies. So it's really important for these patients to have what their fusion partner statuses so that we can gain more information about these. There's another case report about, I'm mistaking my rare entities. And another case report is actually on the SMARCA4 deficient thoracic sarcomas, and not surprisingly, since these tumors are so aggressive, it's not surprising that they would present with severe skeletal issues that demand clinical attention rapidly. But what I thought was interesting and mildly helpful in that report was they talk about claudin-4 being helpful when it's negative for excluding SMARCA4 deficient carcinoma and in support of thoracic sarcoma. They also talk about SOX2 expression supporting a diagnosis of thoracic sarcoma over SMARCA4 carcinoma, which is an area I think everybody's still struggling with to understand these. Finally, for some other wow factor, check out the image in Clinical Medicine in the New England Journal of the physical things that e-cigarettes can do, not to mention the physiologic dangers of them as well. And with that, I certainly thank everybody for their participation. Nice to hear from everyone.
Thank you, Kelly.
Great.
Great journal club. Thank you.
All right. Everybody have a great day. Take care.